People who use drugs are not bad people. They're just people. Harm reduction is anything that helps people reduce the harms associated with drug use. You don't know until you've walked a mile in someone's shoes. I mean, you just don't know.
Utah is in a crisis. According to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, over the last 20 years, Utah has experienced a 223% increase in overdose deaths due to opioids. During 2017, the death toll rose to 456 people. That's more than one person per day. It's also more than all other deaths by accidents combined. Yep, even more than car accidents. People are dying every day from overdoses, but there is a compassionate approach to addressing this crisis. It's called harm reduction. Harm reduction is a set of evidence-based approaches, including medication-assisted treatment, that seek to minimize the harms of drug use for individuals and communities. The main point about harm reduction is that it is all about compassion. It's about reducing the pain and hurt that often comes with substance use disorders, and it's about putting people first. These approaches are proven to reduce the rates of HIV and hepatitis while also saving lives and keeping people in treatment. Canada, Portugal, Australia, and Switzerland all use harm reduction interventions as their primary approach to addressing addiction and have demonstrated enormous health and social benefits by doing so. The problem is, harm reduction is often misunderstood, and there are a whole bunch of myths circulating about the harms of harm reduction. Kind of ironic, right? Hi, and welcome to episode 1 of Debunked. My name is Tim Light, and I'm a team member at the Tribal and Rural Opioid Initiative in the Office of Health Equity and Community Engagement. I know, it's kind of a mouthful. We promote evidence-based best practice across the state of Utah in an attempt to reduce the burden of the opioid crisis right here in our home state. Our efforts focus on our tribal and rural communities, but the reality is we really care about all Utahns, and we want to reduce the burden of the opioid crisis for everyone in Utah. Our main mission is to reduce the stigma that is circulating around harm reduction. This is why we, the Tribal and Rural Opioid Initiative and the Office of Health Equity and Community Engagement, have partnered with the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration, tribal community members, and Utah Public Radio to bring you Debunked. Our 12-person editorial board is made up of local individuals from tribal communities, harm reduction organizations, substance use treatment programs, Utah State University Extension professionals, and public health experts. It's our mission for the next year to bring on as many experts, activists, and people with lived experience as possible to educate us Utahns about harm reduction, to debunk the myths, and give Utahns a clear picture for a compassionate approach to addressing the opioid crisis. And now, we'll jump into our first conversation. Let's introduce everybody. Sandy, do you want to start?
Hi, everyone. I am Sandy Sulzer. I'm an assistant professor of health and wellness at Utah State University. I work with the extension system, meaning helping to do outreach across the state around health and wellness. And I'm the director of the Office of Health Equity and Community Engagement and the Tribal and Rural Opioid Initiative.
Great. Thanks. All right. Dr. Madden, do you want to give us a quick little intro?
Hi, I'm Erin Madden. I'm an assistant professor at University of New Mexico in the Department of Internal Medicine. My research is in addiction health services, especially looking at harm reduction and treatment.
Great, thank you. Thanks. And I think, Heather, what did you want me to call you before? The queen of the universe?
Well,
you want to give us a quick little intro?
You know, I've been known by many names. Some are flattering, some are not. My name is Heather Bush. I am the Syringe Exchange Program Coordinator at the Utah Department of Health. I oversee the administration of Syringe Exchange here in Utah.
Great. Thanks. Yeah, so this is our first show. It's our first conversation on Debunked, and we're really excited about it. So we kind of wanted to set the stage today for future conversations and future episodes. And we feel like in order to do that, we need to talk about the opioid crisis and, you know, sort of the impact and where how it started, where it began, you know, all these things. Dr. Madden, could you comment on, you know, how we got here, how the opioid crisis started?
Sure. Well, opioid addiction has a really long history in the U.S. and internationally. when we're thinking about opioids, too, it's important to know what opioids are. So opioids include drugs that are sold on the illicit street market, which includes heroin, as well as prescription pain relievers like oxycodone, hydrocodone, Percocet, tramadol, fentanyl, all that stuff. So there's been a rise in the past few decades in the number of people who've become addicted to opioids through prescription drugs. In the past, in the 1960s, 70s, and even 80s, most people who were addicted to opioids started their opioid use with heroin.
Interesting.
However, since the 1990s through the current period, most people who are showing up at treatment facilities in the United States started their opioid use with prescription drug. This could have been prescribed actually by their doctor to them. It also could have been what's called a diverted drug, which means someone sold a prescription drug on the illicit street market and someone tried that drug as their first exposure to opioids. Oh, go ahead, sir.
No, I was just going to say that's seems like a really, like it'd be a common issue then if it started with a prescription. It's interesting.
Yeah. So part of the reason why we're seeing a rise in opioid addiction and opioid overdose deaths is because of the ways opioids have been prescribed. So opioid prescribing is not the only reason we are having an addiction crisis. There's other factors that will be addressed in future episodes that are related to inequities related to socioeconomic issues, trauma, and limited access to mental health services. So prescribing is a big part of it, but it's not the only reason we're seeing these things happening.
Okay, cool.
Dr. Madden, can you talk more about, I mean, that sounds like that's how it started, but what does the crisis look like now?
Yeah, so there's two ways of thinking about the crisis and measuring it. So when we talk about the opioid crisis, what we're talking about is an addiction crisis and an overdose death crisis. So in terms of addiction, we are seeing increasing rates, but we're also seeing, while we're seeing more people seeking treatment, we're also seeing high rates of people who need treatment who are not able to get it. So it's sometimes kind of hard to measure how many people have an opioid addiction because it's pretty hard to know who's has the addiction but is not getting treated. So a lot of times when we're talking about measuring the opioid crisis, we focus on the thing that's the easiest to measure, which is the overdose deaths. Unfortunately, right, once someone has died, it's a little too late to have intervened and helped them. So we're all working on getting better measures of addiction. But in terms of overdose deaths, what we're seeing is huge increases across the United States, in some states more than others. So from about 1999 to the most current data from the Centers for Disease Control, 2017, we see as huge increases in opioid overdose deaths. And when we look at the types of opioids that contribute to those deaths, we see a pretty interesting story in regards to whether it's prescription drugs, heroin, or what's called synthetic opioids, which include drugs like fentanyl. So from 1999 through about the 2010 period, this was sort of the first wave of increases in opioid overdose deaths. And that increase was largely driven by prescription opioids. So people who were dying were most often dying because they took too much of a prescription opioid. Around 2010, we saw heroin deaths increasing a lot. So this was the second wave. And heroin deaths started to increased so dramatically that they were sort of reaching the same level as prescription opioid deaths. Since about 2013, 2014, we have a third wave, which is the rise of deaths due to synthetic opioids like fentanyl. And fentanyl is a synthetic opioid, which means a man-made opioid, that is much more potent than both heroin and morphine. And it can be prescribed. So pharmaceutical fentanyl is a prescribed drug often used for chronic pain associated with advanced cancer. But there's also non-pharmaceutical fentanyl, which is illicitly manufactured and often mixed with opioids or with other drugs like cocaine or methamphetamine. And sometimes people think that they're taking a prescribed opioid pain reliever that they're buying on the illicit market. So they think they bought OxyContin, but it actually is illicitly manufactured fentanyl that's a counterfeit OxyContin pill. So So as fentanyl started to flood the illicit opioid market, we saw a lot of people dying due to synthetic opioids. And now, as of 2016, nationally, there's more deaths that are due to fentanyl overdoses than any other type of opioid.
So is fentanyl more potent than these other opioids then?
Yes. So fentanyl is 50 times more potent than heroin and 100 times more potent than morphine.
Gosh, so if somebody thought they were taking a different drug, it would be easier for them to overdose on fentanyl.
Yeah, and someone might say, well, why take that drug, right? Well, one of the reasons is because around 2010, the Centers for Disease Control realized that we were having this overdose and addiction crisis and provided a lot more guidance to prescribers, to physicians, nurse practitioners, about how they should be prescribing opioids. So people became better about how they are prescribing and prescribing more safely. So shorter doses, having people check in more with their physician before they get a refill. And so that stopped a lot of the access to prescription opioids. But what happened was we already had a population of people in this country who are now addicted to opioids, oftentimes through prescribing practices where opioids are being prescribed for too long and too strong. So when people were sort of cut off from their opioid prescriptions for legitimate and illegitimate reasons, there are people with chronic pain who, for them, opioids are a good treatment, and they were also cut off. What a lot of people ended up doing was going to the illicit street market and purchasing heroin or fentanyl or other types of drugs. And so that's part of what we're seeing is why people are going. Why do we see this big increase in street drugs? Well, because when you cut people off, that people try to medicate themselves.
So they were already chemically dependent at that point.
Yeah.
Heather, could you tell us a little bit about what this crisis looks like in Utah?
Yes. So a lot of the same trends are happening here that are happening across the country that Dr. Ben referred to. So in Utah, drug poisoning is still the number one cause of injury deaths, and that outpaces falls, motor vehicle crashes, and things like that.
Can you like say that one more time?
Sure.
That's just a shocking statistic for
sure.
me.
Sure. Drug poisoning is the number one cause of injury death in the state of Utah.
So more than car accidents or anything else?
Yep. So, you know, yeah, you think of somebody falling and hurting themselves or hitting their head or, yeah, getting in a car accident, drug poisoning. And that's a general way of putting it. That's not just opioids. That's any type of too much of any kind of drug.
Yeah.
But usually that's opioids. In 2018, 620 people died of accidental or undetermined drug overdose in Utah. So in other words, that doesn't include suicides.
So that number is likely higher.
Exactly.
You know, when you're talking about stats and I hear 625, you think, oh, it's not like a huge number statistically. But when I think about the individual person, that's 625 families and individuals
yeah,
that we've
and
lost.
That's you know, like, my math isn't great, but close to two people a day in the state of Utah.
That's insane.
Yeah. And we are right now about the 18th in the nation for overdose deaths. And on the one hand, you could say, oh, well, that's better because we used to be seventh.
Yeah.
But our rates have stayed the same about, just other states have gotten worse.
God.
So we're just right in the middle of it with other states around the country. So
we've stopped the growth when other states are seeing that increase. But
yeah, so at least we haven't had the increase. You're right. And that is something to look at. Where we see the most of it is in southeast Utah, so around Price, Carbon County, and in Salt Lake County. So that's where we definitely see the most. And as she was mentioning earlier, prescription is about 53 prescription opioids, not heroin at all, accounted for about 53 of all opioid deaths. And heroin with no prescription opioids accounted for about 34%. But then another 13 were a combination of the two. And then we also see a lot of fentanyl, as she was mentioning. In 2018, we have, that we know of, at least 40 people died of and accidental undetermined overdoses involving fentanyl. And it, that's where it does happen a lot, is that people don't realize either that they're taking an opioid at all. So we talk a lot about using naloxone and other things to prevent an overdose death. Well, if somebody doesn't know they're taking an opioid, then having naloxone, they may not have naloxone, may not know anything about it. Or if they do think they're taking an opioid, like they're taking heroin and it's laced with fentanyl, they don't realize how strong it is.
Yeah.
And naloxone sometimes, I mean, it will work, but some I've heard of people given, you know, 3-4 doses of naloxone, and because the fentanyl is so strong,
yeah,
that it doesn't work.
Can we pause for just 1 second?
Sure.
Dr. Madden, can you tell us what naloxone is?
Sure. Naloxone is an opioid antagonist, which means that it works against an opioid. It takes off. So when someone takes an opioid, their brain's opioid receptors are covered in opioid, the opioid substance. What taking naloxone does is it kicks off the opioid from the brain receptor and it covers it. However, as Heather Bush was saying, right, if the opioid is strong enough, it can't really work. You need a lot of naloxone to kick off all the drugs that are affecting the brain. And naloxone only works for about 30 to 90 minutes. So at times, right, if you've taken a long-acting opioid, you might re-overdose if you don't go to the hospital in time.
Gosh.
And that's a really good point, too. One thing that we say is naloxone is death prevention.
Yeah.
Death prevention from an opioid overdose. But there's a lot of other pieces that are a part of that. The number one is we always say call 911 first. And so then administer naloxone, because you're just bridging that gap in that 5 minutes or whatever until emergency services can get there.
Yeah.
But then they can get there and they can help in case that person goes back into overdose or it doesn't work, but you've already called 911. They're already on their way. And there's a lot of concern that people have that 911's going to come and we're going to get in trouble.
Yeah.
There's going to be an arrest, things like that.
Yeah.
One thing that we recommend to people is don't say it's an overdose. Just say the person is not breathing. Talk about the symptoms. Because if you say in an overdose, they will send the police first. This isn't always the case. Of course, everything is a little bit different. But say the person is not breathing. If the person is afraid of, that they will get in trouble, it's, you know, an option is to leave the scene, leave the front door open, leave the naloxone there to let them know that you used it, put the person on their side so they don't aspirate, and leave the scene if that's a fear. One thing that you had said to me earlier was, what about our Good Samaritan laws?
Yeah.
Our Good Samaritan laws are a little rough here in Utah. They were first passed to include people who were witnessed or a part of an overdose, to protect them. And Good Samaritan laws basically say, like, if you came across a car accident and somebody was injured and you tried to help them.
Like administer CPR or
exactly.
something like
yeah.
that.
Or okay. you tried to, you know, I don't know, anything that you did to try to help them. And if it didn't help, or that person still died or whatever, you wouldn't be held accountable because you tried to help.
Yeah, exactly.
And the same is true for overdose prevention. So someone calls 911 and says, hey, my friend's overdosing or my friend's not breathing. I've administered naloxone, whatever that is. They are protected from, you know, if the naloxone doesn't work, if something happens, they're protected from that. However, it's really vague around when if somebody will they be protected against legal persecution. The law's pretty vague, but they're looking at making it more clear in the 2020 legislative session.
So you mean legal persecution with regards to having potentially also used illicit substances?
Exactly. Or okay. if there's illicit substances on the scene.
Yeah.
And most of the time, that's not a concern. You know, they just want to save that person's life.
Yeah.
But that's why we tell people, save that person's life. But if you fear for your legal safety, then leave the scene. But make sure the priority is saving that person's life, because we don't want somebody to, you know, have the fear of, well, I don't want to call 911 because we'll all get in trouble because we've all been doing drugs.
Yeah.
There is some protection, and it's more important to save someone's life. So
I've definitely seen that fear out there. One night, Dr. MacArthur and I were going to dinner, and we saw someone who was non-responsive, and we did call 911. But then his friends came by, realized we had called. We'd only asked for the paramedics. That those are the only people who were on the way. But nonetheless, they picked their friend up who was non-responsive, put him in a car, and drove off before he could get assistance. And so that made me realize.
Did they give him naloxone or anything? Do you know?
They did not. And we did not have any on us at the time. So, you know, we were all kicking ourselves. But they were so afraid that he would get arrested or in trouble, or potentially that they would face repercussions as well. And so one of the group started yelling at us about how we had jeopardized his safety, essentially. And truly, we were trying to save his life, and they just did not feel that 911 was an avenue to do that.
And that's really unfortunate. And I know a lot of really great EMS workers who are, you know, they'll hand somebody naloxone, you know, even not in an emergency scene.
Yeah.
The Salt Lake City Fire Department's a great resource for that. And most of our law enforcement and everybody's, you know, they're there and they're ready to administer naloxone, and they're most interested in saving someone's life as well.
Yeah.
But that paranoia and that fear is there, and, you know, and trying to, you know, get someone to say, well, your friend's, it doesn't matter if your friend might go to jail if he's dead, you know, but lots of times that is not the first thought that comes to their mind.
I just need to jump in real quick to say that most people who use drugs still care deeply about other people, just like the rest of us, and wouldn't risk allowing someone to die from an overdose. It's true that the people most likely to reverse overdoses are indeed other people who use drugs.
And, you know, the unfortunate thing that we have is people have had lots of bad experiences.
Yeah.
And that's why many times harm reduction, which I know this podcast is about, is important to try to bridge some of those gaps between when somebody is living in a place where they've had bad experiences, obviously, with law enforcement, with even hospitals and clinics and doctors and nurses and people who are supposed to help them, pharmacists. And, you know, they might have trouble finding housing or getting a job or getting a driver's license or anything because of their drug use, and then turn around and then they need some sort of those services, especially medical services, and they don't trust them and they've had such bad experiences. And even though the majority of them, those service providers are wonderful, they don't know that. And so then they avoid those services and then put themselves and others' health and safety in danger because of that.
Gosh, what do you think we can do to help people, I guess, trust those who are, you know, going to provide care for them?
Well, I mean, that's
the big question,
right?
Yeah.
So, and like I said, harm reduction, the idea is that it's anything that helps people reduce the harms associated with drug use. And that's
Can you tell
huge.
Us, I'm sorry, I keep asking you to repeat really important
no,
things.
No, that's fine.
But, I don't know if everyone knows what harm reduction is. Can you just tell us that one more time?
Sure. So harm reduction, specifically related to drug use, is anything that lowers the harmful effects of drug use. And that could be anything. I mean, that could be really anything, because there are a lot of harmful effects from drug use, but it also harm reduction can be applied to lots of different places in our lives.
Yeah.
So it could be reducing the harmful effects of lots of things that we like to do. For example, a seatbelt is harm reduction.
Yeah.
Sunscreen is harm reduction. A bike helmet is harm reduction. It's things that we want to do something that is inherently somewhat dangerous, but then we do something to reduce the harms that may come from that activity so that we can do it more safely and maintain our health. And sometimes it's challenging for people to wrap their heads around. They say, well, the ultimate harm reduction is not to do drugs at all and not to have them. And of course, you know, we can always say that. But when has saying not absolutely not doing anything ever worked with humans? I shouldn't have, you know, 15 Christmas cookies, but, you know, I'm going to. And maybe maybe if I have 13, that's better than having 15. Yeah. And or having one a day instead of several a day. Things like that. I mean, we don't think about it, but we apply those things to our lives. And it's but with people who use drugs, often we take things to a to an extreme, and we want to say, you need to do this and you need to come around to this way, or we won't help you or offer you services, or you obviously don't want to help you help yourself, you don't care about yourself. And those things just are not true. So it really is changing a community and our systems, you know, just something easy, changing everyone's minds on that people who use drugs are not bad people. They're just people. And they may have problems. They may not have problems. They may have a pile of problems that the drugs are either trying to solve or mask, or they're dealing with trauma and it's a response to that. Or they may have an addiction that came out of something, and now they're in a space where that is their only lifeline, or they've tried to get out of it, but because of like all those things where they face stigma everywhere, they just keep coming back. So one of the big things that we try to fight with harm reduction is the stigma. And we treat everybody like they're human and they're equal and they deserve the same rights as anybody else. And if one of those things that they want to do to reduce their harms is get off the drugs, then we'll help them do that. And if they're not ready for that, or they're not in a space, then let's find ways to keep them healthy, keep them alive, and keep them in a space where then when they are ready, those resources are available for them. And they may need to overcome a lot of other things. It's not just a matter of just going to treatment like it's this one-time magical thing that a person walks into a treatment facility and 30 days later they walk out a new person and their whole life is back together. It doesn't work that way. And so offering a community of support and not rejection. And again, people say, well, you're supporting bad behavior. So you're supporting illegal behavior. And I don't know. It is challenging sometimes because it's easy to go to that black and white place. But there really are so much gray. That's one thing I've learned in doing this for many years, is there's so much gray. And every, you know, you don't know until you've walked a mile in someone's shoes. I mean, you just don't know.
Since our work is centered on stigma, I wanted to give you just a quick definition. Irving Goffman defines stigma as an attribute that is deeply discrediting. He defined different types of stigma: tribal stigma, physical deformities, and blemishes of character. Goffman also speaks of public stigma and defines it as negative attitudes among the general public towards a specific group of people.
We can find some sort of empathy and, you know, continuing to punish, stigmatize, ostracize people is not helping either. So let's come up with another way, and that way is just really compassion and treating people equally and helping them in the ways to keep healthy as long as we can.
Great. So, Heather, in addition to this culture of compassion, what else is happening in Utah to respond to this issue?
Great. I told you I would go off about this stuff because
it's
kind of my jam.
We love this.
Some of the things that have been wonderful in Utah. In 2014 is when we first started passing some really good opioid-related legislation. And in 2016, we passed two really great laws. One made naloxone what you call, I'm losing the minds, the words. It's when you can have a prescription for the whole state. I can't think of what it's called.
When the attorney general authorizes.
Standing order.
Standing order. Thank you very much. For some reason, I couldn't remember that. So we have a standing order now for the state of Utah. So people do not need a prescription in order to get naloxone. That before, you had to have a prescription, and you had to purchase it from a pharmacy. So now we have a standing order, so anybody can walk into a pharmacy and purchase naloxone, and we can also distribute it freely, and we do that through Syringe Exchange, which is the other law that passed in 2016, where Syringe Exchange is a program that is based on the desire to reduce bloodborne pathogens transmission with people who inject drugs and share equipment, because sharing.
So what do you mean by bloodborne pathogens?
Thank you. So that's mainly HIV,
okay,
the virus that causes AIDS,
yeah.
Hepatitis B, and hepatitis C. Those are all transmitted from person to person through blood-to-blood contact.
Okay.
One of the most efficient ways to do that is if somebody's injecting with a needle syringe, and somebody else takes that needle and syringe and uses it also to inject. So you're taking, in one way or another, you're taking blood from one person and putting it directly into another. And if one person has HIV, hepatitis C, or hepatitis B, it's a really efficient way to transmit it.
Yeah.
And we do see hepatitis C is actually right now what we call a syndemic with the opioid epidemic.
Uh-huh.
The rise in people using injectable opioids is equal to our rise in hepatitis C infections. So we're facing a hepatitis C epidemic at the same time. And it's, you know, you think of someone who's struggling with addiction and struggling with all the things that come with having an opioid addiction, and now they've got a chronic disease.
I wanted to just highlight some of the impacts of these bloodborne pathogens. Bloodborne pathogens include HIV and hepatitis B and C. HIV leads to AIDS, which means that people's immune system is highly damaged, making them prone to a variety of opportunistic illnesses and infections, and HIV carries a great deal of stigma. Hepatitis B and C are infections of the liver that can lead to cirrhosis and cancer, which in turn lead to liver failure and edema, or extreme swelling of body parts due to excess interstitial fluids. There's a vaccine for hepatitis B, but there's no vaccine for hepatitis C, which is solely a bloodborne pathogen and is not passed through other bodily fluids. According to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the best way to prevent hepatitis C is to avoid behaviors that can spread the disease.
Your behavior, your addiction doesn't have to kill you.
That's a really powerful point. Your addiction doesn't have to kill you.
Yeah.
If we as a society decide to show up for people, even if they are facing an addiction.
Yep.
Yeah, because really it's a health concern. It's like...
It's a public health issue. It's not a criminal issue. It's not a moral issue. It's a public health issue.
So in terms of prevention, Dr. Madden, I just want to go back earlier. You talked a little bit about prescription drugs and their involvement. Can you explain what a prescription drug monitoring program is?
Sure. So a prescription drug monitoring program, sometimes called by its acronym the PDMP, is a state system that prescribers and pharmacists are using to monitor basically who gets prescribed opioids, and in many states also who gets prescribed a class of drug called benzodiazepines, which is drugs like Xanax that are used typically for anxiety disorders. And basically every provider who prescribes an opioid has to tell the PDMP, the monitoring program, that they prescribe a drug to a particular patient, and benzodiazepines in many states too. And then states also share this information a lot of times. So Utah might share with Colorado their database so that patients can't just go to a different state to get multiple prescriptions for opioids. So the reason this was enacted was because there were instances where patients were going to multiple providers and asking for prescription opioids for their own substance use disorder or to divert or sell on the illicit drug market. So this was a way to use data and tracking systems to try and prevent what's also called doctor shopping. So patients going to multiple doctors and asking for prescriptions that would put their own health at risk if they're using all of them, or would be then sold on the illicit market.
Thanks. Gosh. So what kind of, does that work? How does that affect the, how is that working in Utah, I guess, Heather?
Yes. So we do have that in Utah. I don't know as much about it. So I don't want to misrepresent, but it is some of those efforts to look at, and it shows how we're trying to attack this epidemic from many different angles,
okay.
Right? So, you know, a lot of what I work with is working with people who are actually using drugs, but if we kind of go upstream a little bit, let's look at the prescribing policies. And, you know, it's something, you know, we could get way into the weeds here and maybe you guys could do a whole podcast on this, but talking about the whole way that opioids were marketed throughout the 90s and the 2000s on making people think they needed them, that they didn't have the addictive effects that they did and all of those things. So we're trying to backtrack a little bit from that and trying to have a little more of a controlled issue.
Mm-hmm.
But as Dr. Madden said earlier, that's kind of been part of the problem too, is that we reformulate drugs and we try to we make the prescription drugs harder to get, which then draws people to using illegal drugs. And illegal drugs, you don't know what's in them, could have fentanyl, could have, you know, rat poison, could have a lot of things in them, and don't know how strong they are. And then often they're ones that are injected, which adds a whole other layer of problems that come with that. So it's a great piece of the puzzle, and it's helping in a lot of ways. And I think just a lot of awareness that some people who do need opioids, and they have they can use them safely. And some people, you know, do you need a, you know, 14-day prescription for an opioid for getting your wisdom teeth out? Probably not. So some of the changes are trying to do that. They're also trying to get where if someone is prescribed an opioid, they're also prescribed naloxone and taught how to use it. And just really trying to get that awareness around that prescription opioids are opioids and they cause a lot of the same problems that, you know, illicit drugs do as well.
Great. Thanks. Great. Sandy, do you want to introduce the Tribal and Rural Opioid Initiative?
Yeah, so this podcast is something that we're doing as part of the Tribal and Rural Opioid Initiative. We as a team, we target rural and tribal communities in Utah, and we're really working to reduce stigma around treatment best practices. And harm reduction is the gold standard evidence-based best approach to substance use treatment. It includes syringe distribution. It includes overdose reversal medication like naloxone, as we were just talking about, and medication-assisted treatment like methadone. But due to the stigma around these approaches, both among providers and as well as just an average person in the community, there's a lot of stigma and people aren't able to access that evidence-based treatment or those supports. So we are working to educate health professionals and community members in Utah about the scientific evidence, and we're hoping to debunk a lot of the myths so that we can promote health and well-being around opioids and substance use generally in the state of Utah.
We were joined today by Heather Bush, Dr. Aaron Madden, and Dr. Sandra Sulzer. Join us next time when we debunk the myth that good people don't become addicted to drugs. Each new show drops on the second Wednesday of the new month, so episode 2 will drop on March 11th, 2020. Debunked is produced in collaboration with Utah Public Radio. Funding for the show comes from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration Rural Opioid Technical Assistance Program, the Tribal and Rural Opioid Initiative housed in the Office of Health Equity and Community Engagement. Special thanks to KCPW in Salt Lake City, Utah for lending us their studio space for the day. Our editorial board is Dr. Sandra Sulzer, Dr. Suzanne Previdel, Dr. Aaron Madden, Mindy Vincent, Patrick Rizak, Michelle Chapuis, Dr. Marin Voss, Trisha Glass, Lloyd Arrive, and Hilary Deesh. Debunked is produced by Nick Porath, Shalane Smith-Needham,
and Friend Weller, with Nick Porath serving as lead producer. Our creative specialist is Autumn Gibbs. Music for today's episode was created by Nick Porath and Aaron Rollins. Our science advisor is Dr. Aaron Madden, and our program directors are Dr. Sandra Sulzer and Suzanne Prevedel. I'm Tim Light, host and editorial board member. You can find the show on the podcast app, Spotify, upr.org, and anywhere else you listen to your podcast. Check us out on Instagram and Twitter at debunkedpod or on our website, bit.ly/debunkedpod. You can find out more about the work done by the Office of Health Equity and Community Engagement at USU_health.